the more you know about wine, the more you realize you really don't know much.
One thing that is so exciting about Australian wine and I suspect the wine industry internationally is that everyone's got a story.
You know, you're trying to actually just make each one of these vineyards kind of sing its own song.
But I think people don't realize how much energy that's part of the fun of what we do.
Wine writing has devolved to coming up with as many descriptors of the wine. Oh, this is cherries, this is apricots, this is prunes.
We say, so drink the wine. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 363. This week we feature Richard Betts, An Approach to Relaxation Wine, Australia. You gotta love a wine with the name An Approach to Relaxation. It reflects the whole idea that wine is fun. No worries. Richard Betts is owner, along with his wife, Carla. The wine is made in Australia, but the couple live in Amsterdam. Interesting, right? We met with Richard at the Australian tasting in Chicago a few weeks ago and found him to be a straight shooter with a unique take on wine. Be sure to check out the video on our YouTube channel. You can also hear Richard on our Vino Lingo segment, defining the wine term, stay frisky. We're here with Richard Betts, and Richard, I gotta let you say the name of your winery, the most unusual name of a winery ever.
Oh, why, thank you. Well, we call it An Approach to Relaxation.
What a name. I'm blown away by it because it's so completely different, and boy, does it put your head in the right space.
I hope so. Yeah. That's the plan.
Yeah, so how did you decide on a name like that?
You know, it's really important to both myself and my wife and co-founder, co-winemaker, Carla, to do, I mean, you gotta do what you love. And to create an approach to stress winery would just be stupid.
That wouldn't be real bright.
So no, and there, that's not to say there aren't stressful moments, of course there are, and whatever you do, even if you love it. But, you know, we thought, why not call it An Approach to Relaxation? And then within that, the wines also have some cheeky names.
Like?
Well, so we have a friend, very, very close friend, who she and her family make wine in the Rhone Valley in Hermitage. They also like tequila as much as I do. And so we've spent many evenings of the past number of years sitting on the top of the hill of Hermitage, drinking tequila, thinking of funny wine names. And so she came up with, we at An Approach to Relaxation, we only make one red and one white. And this particular friend named both of the wines. So the red is called Sucette, and the white is called Nichon. And we, at the time, we thought that Sucette was, you know, quote unquote, old French for to suckle, like a verb, if you will. It turns out, we go to our first trade tasting, where we're next to Guillaume from Genoa Boulanger in Burgundy, and he's like, do you guys know what you named your wine? And I'm like, yeah, of course, Guillaume means he says to suckle. And he's like, well, that's a dirtier meaning too. I'm like, oh, wow. Well, you know, here we are, wine's bottled, labeled, and thus it lives.
You push on.
You do push on.
Yeah, yeah.
It's so important to not do what you think you're supposed to do because of a genre or a business or, like, I mean, the wine community is amazing. There's also plenty of really staid and boring shit in there. And am I allowed to say shit?
Absolutely. You did twice, so that's okay.
Perfect. Yeah. So why be like anybody else? Do what makes you happy.
I agree. So speaking of something different, it's kind of interesting as I listen to you because you don't have an Australian accent.
I don't. No, I'm not. In fact, we're only allowed 90 days of a year in the country. It's part of being a felon. No, I'm just kidding about the felon part.
No. Okay.
No, the felon.
Gotta go
part.
Now.
Yeah, exactly. Run. Yeah. We ended up there because, I'll take a step back. There's lots of ways to approach the winemaking question. And you can go to school, you can go to Davis, learn how to do it. You know, turns out yeast like to consume sugar, makes alcohol, carbon dioxide. Or, as we've done, is you approach it from the sommelier side. You serve a lot of wine, you drink a lot of wine, you figure out what tugs at the strings of your heart, then you figure out how did that thing come to be, right? So you unknit the sweater, like how did that thing become what it is? And that's what we did, and it turned out what we loved was Grenache grown in sand. And so when you grow Grenache in sand, you don't get much color, But listen, and everybody listening, here's a question for you. Do you taste color or do you smell color? The answer is no, you don't. So why the hell do we even care about it? Instead, so you don't get much color, but you do get all the high-toned, beautiful aromatics, the things that have, you know, led us to feel as though Grenache is the warm climate analogy of Pinot Noir. And that's something interesting. So we go on this search for sand-grown Grenache, and at this point, I'm living in Colorado, and it takes me around the world. And this is almost 20 years ago, early 2000s. So we look in Spain, and we look in Sardinia, and we look in the south of France, where the first wine came from Chateau Reyes, you know, now obviously very well-known, extraordinarily expensive Chateau Neuf du Pape. But it turns out there's not a whole lot of those sorts of circumstances right around Reyes. And so we keep looking. We go to California. We don't find what we're looking for. We go to Australia. And in this tiny little windswept corner of the Barossa Valley, it's a tiny little percentage of the whole, is a place called Vinevale. And two things grow well there, carrots and Grenache. And they don't grow carrots there anymore. It's far too valuable land. But it's sand. And so you're basically at the foot of the Barossa Ranges in the Eden Valley. And as those things have eroded, you end up with an alluvial fan, of which is entirely this very fine white beach sand. It's eroded quartzite and granite, so slightly acidic soil. It's super interesting, and that's where our Grenache grows. And so we own a small vineyard there. It's about 12 and a half acres, of indeterminate age. It's planted at some point in the mid to maybe later 1800s.
You have no idea.
We have no idea.
Wow.
Which is funny. You know, the Australians, they like rules. I don't know, some people just like rules, whatever. And so, you know, we started to use this terminology around it. And of course, they don't codify the Appalachians, because why would we do that? But they do beyond the Barossa Valley. Let's talk about some subregions. That'd be helpful. But they do codify, like, vine age designations. And look, if you've been there forever and ever, and you've passed the deed down, well, you've got something. If you're us, who stumble on this lost vineyard that's 10 by 10 foot planting, so pre-mechanization in the vineyard, it's on, it was on, long, long time ago, a 20-inch wire trellis, 20 inches off the ground, single wire trellis that has fallen over, and you talk to people about when were those used. Well, that was somewhere between, you know, plus or minus 1860. We found farm equipment in the vineyard that had a 25-foot tall prickly pear growing up through it that was stamped, you know, made in Canada in 1880. Like, so all these signs point to this very, very old thing. And then I think the most important one, we make our wine at a friend's winery. They're sixth-generation Barossans. And when you go see Pop, who's 96 today, he says that he picked grapes in that vineyard when he was a kid, and when he was a kid, it was old then.
Oh, wow.
And so it's all circumstantial evidence. And look, we don't care, like, who's older or whatever. The point is that they're just ancient. And so, you know, long ago, they knocked that trellis over, at one point probably abandoned, and they all became their own little bonsai, and every vine is completely unique. We feel, you know, having been in love with sand-grown Grenache for the last 20 years, including a time when people didn't even care about it, we couldn't feel more fortunate to be the custodians of this very special little garden at this point.
Yeah, that's really something. Wow, what a great story.
Thanks.
So is your wife from Australia? Is she American?
No, no. We met in New York, where she was managing the wine programs at the Spotted Pig, the John Dory, and the Breslin. Yeah, and then together we shoved off to Amsterdam. So that's our home.
Oh, really? Well, you're kind of all over the place.
Yeah, the United Airlines thinks we're pretty cool right now.
You must have some really good miles.
Yeah.
Good God.
True.
So how long have you had the winery?
So I had a first project. We started with 2001 vintage called Betts and Scholl. And I was still working full-time as a sommelier in Aspen. And we grew that and grew that and grew that. And in 2009, sold that to a small public company. Carla and I started and worked with them for a couple of years. Yeah, fell in love with Carla, met her in New York, we fell in love, and decided that we wanted to work together. And so we started this new winery and Approach to Relaxation with the 2014 vintage.
Nice.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's one of those names that, you know, often people will say every name's been taken, and there is no way on earth that one was taken, even thought of.
Totally. Isn't that, I think it's Rick Springfield or something, that's that old rock and roll song, All the Good Ones Are Taken.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we patented that too, but no, I'm just kidding. Trademarked, rather. No, it's true, everything is taken. It's really hard to name things these days.
You're an interesting person to talk to. I'm saying that right away. I usually hold that if you are at the end of an interview, but so that kind of sets up the next question is, what is the myth that you like least in the wine business? Because there are a few of those.
Oh my God. That's a good question. You know, there's so much dogma and there's not enough data. And with that, you can also have too much data. Like there's for sure too many do everything by the numbers. That's not the point. I'm not at all suggesting do everything by the numbers. Like, I think it's a very, very much a touch and feel thing, but you have to understand what you're touching and feeling. You know, there's so many, you know, I get at this question all the time. Well, do you use commercial yeast or do you add sulfur or is your wine natural? And I just want to turn the question around. It's like, do you even fucking know what when I tell you what the answer is, are you even going to understand it? Because my guess is if you're asking me that question, 99.999% of the time is you are educated. You've learned these like hot button questions to ask and you've developed an opinion based on them, but you probably have no clue about the science, none whatsoever, you know? So I used to find them annoying. At this point, like, I don't really care if you drink my wine or not, you know? I actually don't. We don't make much. It's exactly what we want it to be and it's found its fans. But it used to make me mad, but now it makes me sad. And one, anger is just a dumb emotion anyways, but I'm sad for the person asking the question, you know? And when they ask that question, they're like, oh, I jabbed him with it, I got him. And it's like, well, you don't know what you got or not. You just think you've got a hot button question. And they're not in a place where you can say, you know what, let me just put my arm around you and let's just like have a talk. Like, let's really think about that. Like, for example, wine isn't natural. Stable wine isn't natural. It's not. It's a continuum, and no one knows that. Like, you know, some people know it. Like, it starts as sugar, gets consumed, becomes alcohol. It doesn't stop there. It doesn't stop there. You're only like halfway along the continuum. It has to keep going because the acetobacter get involved, and hello, it's called vinegar. That's what it wants to be. If left to its own devices, it wants to be vinegar. It doesn't want to be wine. It takes intervention for it to actually be wine. So is it natural? You tell me. And the fact that like that term gets taken and somehow implies that everything else is not natural, it's like, fuck you. Like, come on, get over it. Be smarter. It's be smarter, do better work. And if you're not going to be smarter and you're not going to do better work and you're not going to do the research and you're not going to have a conversation, then I'm uninterested. Completely and totally. And it just kind of goes with everything in life. Like, be willing to have your mind changed. Be open to learning. And it's, look, I get it. It's harder and harder for young wine professionals to taste, you know, what's great wine. That's in the eye of the beholder. But we can say there are some benchmarks. You taste great old Bordeaux. And I mean, you know, old. And why does it matter? Well, taste the old wines. Right. Why does Burgundy matter? Taste the great wines. You know, why does Barolo matter or Brunello? And regretfully, it's very expensive to do that today. It's prohibitive. And, you know, for better or worse, I was the lucky kid that got to drink all of that stuff all the time. And part of that's my gray hair. Speaking of that, part of it's the environment I put myself in. And so I was fortunate to have that basis, and it gives you perspective, which having perspective is everything, you know, it's everything. And regret, I know it's hard today. So there needs to be something done to create, you need to create context for people. And only with context can you be smart. It's just a fact. So they should not waste all this energy on being dumb. They should expend that energy on trying to figure out how to get smart. And so that's the thing that bothers me the most. It's dogma and not data.
Well, I'd like to think that's what we're doing. We're trying to
absolutely. That's why I'm sitting here with you. I'm excited about it.
Yeah, no, it's cool.
Yeah, so anyone who's offended, please call me up. I'll spend the time with you. Let's figure this out.
Well, I think that's what it is. Sometimes you have to get people's attention to get them to learn or to change their preconceived notions.
Yeah.
given you one good question in that regard, I'm going to throw another one at you, which has become my favorite question. And for all the years you've been doing this, and I'm sure you've done plenty of media events and talked to people, what is the one question you don't get asked that you would like to be asked?
You know, I have to tell you, I was recently asked this question, but it was in the context of a spirits thing. And I just loved it. And I still love it. It's still my favorite question I've ever been asked. So that's not what you asked me, but I'm going to tell you anyways. And it was like, if you could, it's that, you know, if you could have dinner with anyone living or dead, who would it be? And it fell right out of my mouth, and it was John Hughes, who's Chicagoan, actually. And I think that guy knew how to love, knew how to care, knew how to, like, feel pain and emote and share it. I think some of the greatest movies ever made. And so I wish I could be asked a lot, because I want to jump up and down about what it means to actually be compassionate and to, like, to feel and be vulnerable and or any question that allows for that. You know, I don't think there's enough compassion, particularly in America right now. And it's tough. I'm biting my tongue. I start to tear up about it. But yeah, we need more compassion.
I would agree with that.
Yeah.
It's a good answer. Yeah. When it comes to being a winemaker, I mean, you're constantly dealing with the public in these tastings, and I think you've already covered this a little bit, but it may be softer, gentler way. You know, when you get people who don't want to try certain things, is there a particular approach you use?
Yeah, I have compassion. I'm just like, what do you like? You just get them to smile. You don't have to try my wine. And I don't mean that from a point of arrogance or from a point of financial stability. I have to go to work every single day, and the last thing I want to be is arrogant. I can have an opinion, be passionate about it. That's different than being arrogant or ignorant. It's funny. My mom told me this as a kid, and of course you didn't want to hear anything your mother said, but it was you catch more bees with honey. Right? And so later in life, you figure it out. That's just another way of saying have compassion. Like, I can wake up every day and hopefully bring more positivity to the world, touch somebody, make them smile. And frequently, that's embracing, you know, whatever it is they want to bring to the table, whatever availability they have for you. Like, if you don't have the availability or the bandwidth to think about the topic that's being presented at my little table with my little wine, that's okay. Like, are you happy today? Are you enjoying the wines? Are you having a good time? You know, like, what is it that makes you tick? And I think by engaging with people on that level, you actually do affect a lot of change. And, you know, next time they will come see you. I frequently get asked, less now that the craze is largely over, but, like, what do you think about White Zinfandel? And everyone thinks, like, oh, the fancy salon is going to say it's shit. And in fact, it's not shit. It's fucking awesome. And you know why it's awesome? Because it took the Coke drinker and it made him a wine drinker. And if you're a wine drinker, well, you're one step closer. First of all, you're drinking wine. So for me, that's gigantic. A+, that's all that matters. But you're also now one step closer to my hemisphere or my friend's hemispheres, where maybe you'll be curious and like, well, what about that rosé? Or what about that white wine? And what, well, if I like that wine, will I like that orange wine? If I like that orange wine, am I liking tannins? If I like tannins, am I going to like red wine? And now the Coke drinker is drinking whatever it is. And that's kind of amazing. Right?
You have to have stepping stones.
Absolutely.
Or none of us would be where we are.
At all.
Yeah. No, it's a very good point. I like that. So you were talking before, and I know you're partially kidding about the idea. You are limited to how long you can actually be working in Australia?
Yeah, 90 days a year. I mean, my wife and I can each figure out how to write a $5 million check in the country, but I don't really have $5 million to write a check in the country.
You're there strictly for harvest or post-harvest?
No, no, no.
How do you do that?
Harvest is like, look, we harvest Grenache and Semillon, and so two varietals. So the winery we work at, they harvest, it's like a three-month vintage. Because they do everything from Sauvignon Blanc through Shiraz,
right.
Cabernets, and Zinfandel, et cetera. It's a tiny little family winery, but they have lots of different things. So it takes a number of months, but the Grenache minute is 21 days, which means you have to build in a bunch of time in the front because you got to be there to decide when is it actually ready. So it's like harvest is like a 5-week event for us. And so that leaves you still quite a few others. So we're planting up a portion of, so we have the 12 and a half acres of the old stuff, and we're very focused on really not just preserving, but continuing to develop the idea of what the old Barossa was about. And so we had an additional 4 acres of like decrepit
well, the aforementioned prickly pear and bamboo and some olive trees that weren't in good nick. So we tipped it all out, which is to say bulldozed in Australian, and took cuttings from our own vines at pruning a year ago. They'd been in the nursery developing their own roots, and they'll go in on their own roots. So Selection Masal from our, you know, potentially some of the very first Grenache that went to Australia, which would be then some of the oldest stuff on the planet. And so we're going to plant that up, the remaining 4 acres, to bush vines, dry grown, just like everything should be. So we'll go do that. We'll go for a period around the semi-on harvest. So these sorts of things. So you pop in when sure. necessary. And in the meantime, sense. We have an amazing team of essentially 2 people. So everything's done organically. And no, I don't have to be there to pull, every bit of cow throp out. But, you articulate the vision and make it work.
Excellent. Yeah, that makes sense to me. How many cases are you doing?
Oh, gosh, a total of 1,000.
Nice. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, I mean, it's tiny. You can keep your arms around it.
Tiny is good. Tiny is good for me.
It is good. It's bigger isn't better. It's like special is better.
Yeah. I completely agree. So I'm guessing you, because of your size, you probably don't have a tasting room?
Is it? Oh, gosh, no, not at all.
So is it direct-to-consumer or these events?
We have a tiny bit of direct-to-consumer in the United States, but that's actually becoming less and less important for a lot of reasons. But we have a great following in Australia. We have a great, really, the wine community in the United States has been so good to us for so long. And part of it's because we've been a part of it for so long, and part of it's just, it's a great community. But both Europe and Asia are becoming more and more meaningful as markets to us, which we couldn't be more excited about. Because then, this is part of the dream, right? I get to go be in Asia, working, right? have never really explored it, which is amazing for a guy that, has traveled billions and millions of miles. And so now we're just getting to know Japan. We're just getting to know Taiwan and Korea and Singapore and Hong Kong. And that's what a gift.
Not a bad deal.
Yeah, so wine provides that too.
Yeah. So for our listeners who want to learn about you online, what is your website?
It is www, of course, anapproachtorelaxation.com. It's really a long one. We have a motto. It's called Stay Frisky. You can also put in stayfrisky.com, and that'll redirect you to an approach to relaxation.
Oh, my God. This has been really interesting. I really appreciate you taking the time, Richard, to come down here and chat with us.
Great. It's been a pleasure. Thank you. I'm grateful for the opportunity.
Same here. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Learn more by visiting anapproachtorelaxation.com.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines is produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Theme song and original music written and recorded by Tim Dondarevo. Additional original music by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Photos by Jeanette Herniak and Catherine Shearer. Copyright 2019.